Disclaimer: in this chapter, we will be discussing the assault and murder of many women. This chapter may be triggering for some listeners, and this will be the only warning, so please do not listen if you're sensitive to this topic.
What are we talking about today? What do you think?
I have a little bit of insider information, but I'm going to let you go ahead and say it. I'm super excited about this one.
I don't know. Like, I hope it's kind of interesting, but I feel like it's a tale overtold. But we are going to be going over the Green River Killer today.
Yay. But overtold when it first happened. You know what I mean? Like, he has not been in the news for a very long time. So it's still fresh.
That is fair. It's something I feel like was over discussed, I guess, in people like my age, just because, I don't know. When I was growing up, we all would watch Eight Simple Rules, and the redheaded girl on that show was in Green River Killer as one of the victims, like the movie remake. And it was just so sad to see her in a position like that, because it was like a kid's show. And the next thing you know, she's like naked and afraid. And yeah, it was horrible. It was horrible. So I think
I was actually surprised that she was in that movie because of who she played on TV. Do you know what I mean?
Totally. It broke my heart. It made me feel like it made a remake movie feel more real. I don't know.
That makes sense. Yeah, it makes sense.
So let's get into some background information and tell the story. Born on February 18th, 1949, in Salt Lake City, Utah, Gary Ridgway had a seemingly normal childhood. But just like other killers we have recently covered, around the age of 15, he stabbed a 6-year-old boy just to see what it was like to stab someone and to see how it worked. Luckily, the boy survived.
That's one of those things that that wasn't really widely known until after he was caught. And it was, I don't know, it was kind of creepy to hear that he had stabbed somebody at such a young age just to see what it felt like.
Right. Like, it's weird, but it's like, that is how they start. Like, look at Aiden Fucci or whatever. He just like had his knives and he wanted to know what it was like.
No, exactly. That's what they do. That's how it starts usually. Yeah.
And back in the day, though, they could like get away with it, or like it didn't like immediately send alarms of a possible, you know, future serial killer. These days, somebody does something bad like that, and it's like, holy freaking crap, sound the media. This 10-year-old kid just murdered his 6-year-old cousin. What the?
So
Gary also had a bedwetting problem in his early teens and later confessed to being sexually attracted to his mother. Now, I use the word confess, but, you know, it's alleged. Allegedly, his mommy touched him.
Right. And that came out when I can't remember which FBI profiler was doing the interview with him. But he did. That's one of the stories that he came out with during that FBI profile or interview, I guess, not interrogation, but interview.
Like, I'd believe it just because a lot of these men who kill women and like almost look at them as if they're lesser than, you know, an insect on the ground, like they often have a similar story of their moms either being physical with them or in some regard sexually molesting them. He claimed that he wanted to kill her because of it, and later told a psychologist that he was interested in stabbing due to his interest in his mother. So like, he got sexual gratification from his mom, and that made him so angry that he wanted to murder.
I feel really blessed to have not had boys. Not that I was like, you know, sick or twisted, but you dodged a bullet there, in my opinion. I'm sorry, continue.
Who did?
I did, by not having boys.
Oh,
I didn't have to worry about. I mean, I had to worry, obviously, but there's other things I didn't have to worry about because I had girls. I just feel very lucky that I had girls. Yeah.
He had clear recollections of his mother washing his genitals after he would wet the bed. Some experts later theorized that he was unconsciously killing his mother over and over again. Could you hear background noise there?
No.
Okay. Gary was the son of Mary and Thomas Ridgway. He was the middle child and had two brothers. His home life seemed normal, but other relatives did claim that Mary and Thomas would get into fights. Another important tidbit to perhaps how Gary grew to be the Green River Killer was that his father was a bus driver who would often complain about the presence of sex workers. So he'd be driving, he'd be like, oh, there's those whores working that corner.
Yeah.
Somebody should take care of those.
Like, yeah.
Uh-oh. Gary graduated from Tai High School. I think it's Tai. Tai. T-Y-E. Tai.
Yeah, Tai. Maybe just Tai. I don't know.
If it was just Tai, why the two E's? But you know what? Tai. Okay, moving on. He graduated from that high school in 1969 and married his 19-year-old high school girlfriend, Claudia Craig. He joined the United States Navy and was sent to Vietnam, where he served on board a supply ship and saw combat. It's so weird that so many of these stories are so similar.
I know. It's like it's almost like a roadmap, almost.
Yeah. Like, it's not a coincidence. We can literally see similarities in what leads people to do these crazy ass things.
Usually, yeah. Not always, but usually, absolutely.
During his time in the military, Gary had frequent sexual intercourse with sex workers and contracted gonorrhea. Gross. Although angered by this, he continued this activity without protection. So he spread that nasty everywhere. His marriage ended within a year. Surprise, surprise.
Yeah, weird.
When questioned about Ridgway after his arrest, friends and family described him as friendly but strange. His first two marriages resulted in divorce because of infidelities by both partners. His second wife, Marcia Winslow, claimed that he had placed her in a chokehold. Not cool, dude. Just kidding. He doesn't.
No.
He became religious during his second marriage, going door to door, reading the Bible aloud at work and at home, and insisting that his wife follow the strict teachings of their pastor. AKA, he just liked control over women. And what better thing to preach than the classic Bible, let's say.
Yeah.
Despite his beliefs, Ridgway continued to solicit the services. Despite his beliefs, or fake beliefs, Ridgway continued to solicit the services of sex workers and wanted his wife to participate in sex in public and inappropriate places. Sometimes even in areas where his victims' bodies were later discovered.
Oh, I remember that. I remember that. Oh.
So nasty. Imagine being that woman, being like, you motherfucker.
After the fact, my gosh.
Yeah.
Couldn't even imagine. Ugh.
That would be horrible. According to women in his life, Gary had an insatiable sexual appetite. His three ex-wives and several ex-girlfriends reported that he demanded sex from them several times a day. Often, he would want to have sex in a public area or in the woods. Gary himself admitted to having a fixation with sex workers, with whom he had a love-hate relationship. He frequently complained about their presence in his neighborhood, much like his father, and he also took advantage of their services regularly. So, he'd be like, fucking whores, how much?
Oh, what a pig.
not that I think that prostitutes are whores. I mean, like, all I'm saying is that usually, like, men who hate prostitutes, they're like, those dirty sluts. Like, that's what they say. Gary Ridgway said he hated prostitutes and didn't want to pay them for sex. Some have speculated that Ridgway was torn between his lusts and his staunch religious beliefs.
Yeah. Okay.
I guess.
Possible.
Ish. With his second wife, Marcia, he actually had a son named Matthew. Now imagine if he would have had a daughter there.
You know, there are many serial killers who did have daughters. Some of them did abuse them, but some of them didn't, you know. Yeah, so
I just feel like he would have been the type to do it, I guess.
Yeah. And I mean, you're going to get into it, I'm sure, but this guy had absolutely no moral compass when it came to his kid. So, I mean, yeah.
Yeah, we can talk about it more after. If I miss something and you want to talk about something, you can take over for a bit. But diving back in, let's touch on the 1980s and 1990s. Ridgway is believed to have murdered at least 71 teenage girls and women near Seattle and Tacoma, Washington. In court statements, Ridgway later reported that he had killed so many that he lost count. A majority of the murders occurred between 1982 and 1984. The victims were believed to be either sex workers or runaways whom he picked up along Pacific Highway South. Ridgway sometimes showed the women a picture of his son to trick them into trusting him. They would engage in sexual activity. Ridgway would wrap his forearm around the front of their necks and use the other arm to pull back as tightly as he could, strangling them.
He killed. And that's what I was talking about, actually, with his kid.
Oh, like showing photos and being like, yeah. Hey.
And having little like toy cars and stuff in his truck to kind of put the girls at ease when they knew there was a predator out there. That's how he was able to continue doing what he was doing, by using his son as a kind of a buffer, I guess.
So sick.
Yeah. There was, you might get into it, but there was even one time that his son was in the truck when he picked one up.
Oh, yeah. So fucking fucked.
Yeah.
Most of their bodies were dumped in wooded areas around the Green River in Seattle Tacoma International Airport, or by there, and other dump sites within South King County. There were also two confirmed and another two suspected victims found in the Portland, Oregon area. The bodies were often left in clusters, sometimes posed, and usually nude. He would sometimes return to the victims' bodies and have sexual intercourse with them. Ridgway later explained that he did not find necrophilia more sexually satisfying, but having sex with the deceased reduced his need to obtain a living victim and thus limited his exposure to being caught. So for as long as he felt he could. Yeah.
I think later he also, I wish I could remember which interrogations were which, but he had also said that when he would go back to one of his victims' bodies, he was saving money, basically, almost like girl math, kind of twisted, but he wouldn't have to pay for it. I mean, not that he'd have to pay for it anyways, but you know what I mean? He actually said that
and he wouldn't have to risk it. So like literally, like I get it. I wish I didn't get it. Like it shouldn't make sense, but like it makes sense.
Unfortunately, it makes sense.
Gross.
Still a pig. What a pig.
Because most of the bodies were not discovered until only the skeletons remained, two victims are still unidentified, like to this day. Ridgway occasionally contaminated the dump sites with gum, cigarettes, and written materials belonging to others, and he even transported a few victims' remains across state lines into Oregon to confuse the police. In the early 1980s, the King County Sheriff's Office formed the Green River Task Force to investigate the murders. Task Force members included Robert Keppel and Dave Reichert, who periodically interviewed incarcerated serial killer Ted Bundy in 1984. According to Keppel, Bundy actually volunteered himself to take part in the investigation. Keppel described receiving the shocking request from a detective of the Seattle Police Department. It was a letter from a wannabe consultant and the most unlikely person I ever expected to be of assistance in the Green River murders. The letter came from a cell on death row in Florida, and the sender was Theodore Robert Bundy. I was stunned. That's what he ended up saying.
Yeah, and there was a movie made about that. It was called The River Man, because that's what Bundy called the Green River Killer, the river, the river your, man. Or he'd call him your river man. It's actually kind of creepy, his insight, and that's...
It's so on point, I know.
Mm-hmm. I'll let you continue, but yeah, creepy.
I mean, for those of you not familiar with Ted Bundy, which I'm sure you are.
And I did an episode when you were away. I did a two-parter about Ted Bundy, and that was one of the ones that I wanted to redo with you, because your reaction and your wit to some of this stuff, I think, is what makes the podcast as great as it is. So I want to redo that one, but I did do a two-parter on Ted Bundy while you were away.
Well, so by this point, Bundy had already been imprisoned for several years for murder, rape, burglary, and necrophilia. And at the time, he was awaiting his execution, which would ultimately come in 1989. Having deplorable but valuable firsthand experience with the same kinds of killings that had been happening in the Green River area, Bundy proved to be an asset to the case. Sadly, interestingly, whatever you want to call it, he became a regular interviewee of Keppel and Reichert and offered his unfiltered opinion on the psychology of the still active Seattle serial killer, as well as his motivations and behavior.
And but because normal people, even those detectives and profilers and people who say they get into the minds of these killers, there's no way that you would just know some of this stuff. And Ted Bundy being one, thinking that way, being that way, he was in it. He knew it.
Yeah, for sure. According to Reichert, Ted Bundy also shared several things in common with Gary Ridgway, especially in regard to mindset. Quote, "First off, there's no remorse. He doesn't have any feelings toward anybody, his family included. And that's what I saw in Bundy and what I saw in Ridgway." Bundy offered his opinions on the psychology, motivations, and behavior of the killer. During one interview session, Bundy reportedly suggested that the uncaught Seattle serial killer was most likely revisiting his dump sites to perform necrophilia on the corpses. He advised the investigators that if they found a fresh grave, they should stake it out and wait for the killer to return. Bundy's theory.
Do you remember that one Criminal Minds episode? It was one of the first ones ever.
Yes, I do. Yeah, and like the leaves over the body.
Yeah. And the guy and the killer kept going back and putting like lipstick and stuff on it.
Yeah.
Creepy. I believe that that's what that was based off of. This
for little... sure it was, because Criminal Minds literally would base it off of
sometimes very loosely, but this was pretty accurate
on point. Yeah. Whew. Yeah, totally. And I think about that every time I read this. I'm like, ugh. Bundy's theories turned out to be absolutely correct, and the police were able to use them to collect samples and provide evidence for an arrest warrant. However, it took police until 2001 to finally arrest Gary Ridgway. Ridgway was arrested in 1982 and 2001 on charges related to prostitution. He became a suspect in the Green River killings in 1983. In 1984, Ridgway passed a polygraph test, because those tests are not reliable. Oh my god. On April 7th, 1987, police took hair and saliva samples from Ridgway. Around 1985, Ridgway began dating Judith Mawson, who became his third wife in 1988. Mawson claimed in a 2010 television interview that when she moved into his house while they were dating, there was no carpet. Detectives later told her he had probably wrapped a body in the carpet. In the same interview, she described how he would leave for work early, I guess for overtime pay. So that was his excuse. Mawson speculated that he must have committed some of the murders while supposedly working these early morning shifts. She claimed she had not suspected Ridgway's crimes before she was contacted by authorities in 1987 and had not even heard of the Green River Killer before that time because she did not watch the news.
Which is, like, bizarre, being a woman, you know, even BTK's wife knew, because BTK was saying lock your doors and stuff, because he knew it was common knowledge that somebody, i.e.
Here's what I think the difference was. BTK really cared about people recognizing his craft, almost. Like, he really seen it, like, that he wanted people to know. Gary was more controlling of his women and probably tried to hide it more. Like, he was more of, like, a coward under the grass, slithering around, trying to do what he could do. And, you know, it's very possible that he was controlling and manipulative in those marriages, didn't let her have girlfriends, didn't let her watch TV, listen to things. And if that were the case, then I would understand how she didn't know. Any other reason, like, if he was just a normal husband and, like, serial killer by night, my god, lady, turn on the news.
No doubt.
Listen to a podcast. I'm just kidding. Author Penny Moorhead interviewed Ridgway in prison, and he said while he was in the relationship with Mawson, his kill rate went down and that he truly loved her. Of his 49 known victims, only 3 were killed after he married Mawson. Mawson told a local television reporter, quote, "I feel I have saved lives by being his wife and making him happy." I just want to say that, like, I don't know, that rubs me the wrong way just a little bit. Like, maybe she's the nicest person ever, but, like, to me, saying that is insensitive to his other wives, because it almost sounds like, you know, he killed more prostitutes while he was with certain wives. Mm.
Yeah. It's weird. Yeah. Weird.
The samples collected in 1987 were later subjected to DNA profiling, providing the evidence for his arrest warrant. On November 30th, 2001, Ridgway was at the Kenworth Truck Factory, where he worked as a spray painter, when police arrived to arrest him. Ridgway was arrested on suspicion of murdering 4 women nearly 20 years earlier after being first identified as a potential suspect when DNA evidence conclusively linked semen left in the victims to the saliva swab taken by the police. Now, again, that was, like, years later that they finally got to his swab, I believe, and then they arrested him. The 4 victims named in the original indictment were Marcia Chapman, Opal Mills, Cynthia Hines, and Carol Ann Christensen. 3 more victims, Wendy Caulfield, Deborah Bonner, and Deborah Estes, were added to the indictment after a forensic scientist identified microscopic spray paint spheres as a specific brand and composition of paint used at the Kenworth factory during the specific time frame when these victims were murdered. So, like, that's cool. That's awesome that they were able to use, like, forensics and science to use, oh, yeah, very detailed, interesting, I don't know.
It is. It's crazy how they were able to do that, actually.
Yeah, and very, like, very good thinking on whoever was, like, taking evidence. Because these days you see some crime scenes absolutely just get tanked because they miss, you know, bagging it correctly.
Yeah.
As Mawson put it, Ridgway was the perfect husband and had always treated her like a newlywed, even after they'd been together for 17 years. In reality, Ridgway later confessed he had been tempted to kill Mawson and only passed because it might have increased his chances of getting caught. So she's like, he was great. And he's like, yeah, I thought about murdering her a few times, but I had to stop myself.
Yeah, stellar husband.
After his cooperation, he was given 48 life sentences that would be served consecutively. Then 10 years was added to each sentence for the crime of tampering with evidence, aka fucking the bodies, and more, and other things.
Oh my god.
Yeah, it's gross. This would increase his overall prison term by 480 additional years. And in 2011, a 49th body was found that they linked to Ridgway. So that added yet another life sentence to his prison term. When his trial was over, Gary had confessed to more confirmed murders than any serial killer in America at that point. He claimed that murdering young women was his real career. In part two, we're going to dive more into Gary Ridgway's victims and his monstrous crimes that spanned over his life. So I figured in part two, we can go through the victims, name names, and hit all those bases.
Cool.
If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe to the podcast and share with your friends. If you don't mind giving us a 5-star rating, it will help our show grow. You can also find us on Facebook and YouTube at True Crime Story Podcast, where the discussion can continue. If you wish to contact us, you may do so via Facebook or email at truecrimestorypod@gmail.com. I'm Bree.
And I'm Char.
And we'll see you in the next chapter. Bye.